If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
President Trump suggested today that Russia will meddle in the upcoming midterm elections in favor of the Democrats because, quote, they definitely don't want Trump. Then again, neither did we.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. On today's show, Seth talks to MSNBC's Jacob Soboroff. Then, exclusively for this podcast, Jacob answers a few more questions backstage. But first, a closer look.
President Trump has once again falsely accused the FBI of spying on him, but it turns out there was one person who really did secretly tape Trump, his own lawyer. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. The president is facing an intense political backlash over his press conference last week with Vladimir Putin. His administration still has thousands of migrant children jailed and separated from their parents, and his personal fixer, Michael Cohen, might be cooperating with federal investigators. So naturally, Trump has decided the appropriate response is to threaten a war with Iran.
President Trump is once again threatening the annihilation of a country. Very late last night, Trump tweeted out in all capitals, quote, to Iranian President Rouhani, never ever threaten the United States again or you will suffer consequences the likes of which few throughout history have ever suffered before. We are no longer a country that will stand for your demented words of violence and death. Be cautious.
Wow. You can take the crazy old man out of Queens, but you can't make him stop yelling at foreigners. Also, you don't get to say be cautious when you're tweeting in all caps. That's like a British person screaming at the top of their lungs, keep calm and carry on! We're all gonna die! Trump's threat of war against Iran was just the latest in a series of unhinged comments over the weekend. Since the start of his presidency, Trump has also nursed the paranoid fantasy that the FBI and the Democrats were spying on him. Over the weekend, he tweeted looking more and more like the Trump campaign for president was illegally being spied upon, surveillance, for the political gain of crooked Hillary Clinton and the DNC. I think my favorite part of that one is surveillance in parentheses. Like, in case you didn't know what spied upon means, here's a longer word for it. Surveillance must have been on his word of the year calendar. Surveillance. Oh, spied upon. See you next January, words. Trump's latest outburst came after the Justice Department released a redacted version of the application they filed to surveil a Trump campaign advisor named Carter Page. There he is. God bless him. That's how your dog looks at you when he's torn a pillow apart and you haven't started yelling at him yet. I took care of that pillow for you. I did good, right? The FBI believed that Page has been collaborating and conspiring with the Russian government. On Sunday, Page went on TV to defend himself, but would not answer the simple question of whether he had relationships with Russian officials.
You have relationships with Russian government officials, right? Well, let's see what they're referring to specifically.
But Carter, you didn't answer. I mean, you have relationships with Russian government officials, true? Yes.
Well, let's see what they're talking about. You know,
I'm just asking you a straight question. Do you have relationships with Russian government officials? I can tell you, I don't.
Oh. Oh, you don't, Jake Tapper? You think Wolf Blitzer is his real name? Beard, glasses? That's obviously Vladimir Putin in a disguise. Paige. Smiling Carter Page was then asked if he had ever served as an informal advisor to the Kremlin, a charge he denied despite some powerful evidence.
Did you ever advise the Kremlin or work with the Kremlin on anything?
Look, Jake, no.
But you did advise the Kremlin. I mean, I just want to make it clear. You did advise the Kremlin back in 2013 or 2012, somewhere in there.
Jake, it's really spin. I mean, I sat in on some meetings, but, you know, to call me an advisor, I think, is way over the top.
Except in a 2013 letter you wrote, it says, quote, over the past half year, I have had the privilege to serve as an informal advisor to the staff of the Kremlin in preparation for the presidency of the G20 summit next month, where energy issues will be a prominent point on the agenda. That's August 2013. That's yourself calling yourself an informal advisor to the Kremlin.
You know, informal, having some conversations with people.
I have never seen anyone so happy about a losing hand. I have a full house, Carter. Well, I have a Metro card and a CVS receipt. But Trump's obsession with being secretly taped is not new. It's something he's been fixated on throughout his presidency, like when he falsely accused President Obama of having his wires tapped, or when he tweeted, James Comey, better hope that there are no tapes of our conversations. It's almost like he got secretly taped at some point, and waiting for that tape to come out is slowly driving him insane. And he tries not to think about that tape, but for whatever reason, every time he pees, he can't get it out of his mind. And even Trump's explanations for his bizarre comments about secret tapes are themselves incriminating. Like when he was asked about his Comey tweet and rambled like he was under police interrogation.
Why did you want him to believe that you possibly did that?
Well, I didn't tape him. You never know what's happening when you see that the Obama administration, and perhaps longer than that, was doing all of this unmasking and surveillance, and you read all about it, and I've been reading about it for the last couple of months about the seriousness of the and horrible situation with surveillance all over the place. So you never know what's out there, but I didn't tape, and I don't have any tape, and I didn't tape.
He's like the bus from the movie Speed. He can't stop talking or he'll explode. Trump's paranoia about being secretly taped doesn't just cause him to accuse others of spying on him. He has also repeatedly insisted, without any prompting, that there are no secret recordings proving that his team colluded with Russia. Like when he tweeted, out of nowhere, they have zero tapes of T people colluding. Or when the P-tape allegations first surfaced in 2017, Trump insisted he was always careful when he traveled abroad because he was always afraid he was being recorded.
I'm surrounded by bodyguards. I'm surrounded by people. And I always tell them, anywhere, but I always tell them, if I'm leaving this country, be very careful. Because in your hotel rooms, and no matter where you go, you're going to probably have cameras. I'm not referring just to Russia, but I would certainly put them in that category. But in those rooms, you have cameras in the strangest places. Cameras that are so small with modern technology, you can't see them and you won't know. You better be careful, or you'll be watching yourself on nightly television.
Okay, so hold on, Just a tip. If someone asks you, did you pee on a bed with hookers, the right answer is, no, that's disgusting, I'm married. Not, no, there are cameras everywhere. So Trump is obsessed with being secretly taped, but it turns out it wasn't Russia or the FBI he should have been worried about. It was his own lawyer.
The New York Times is just reporting that Michael Cohen secretly recorded a conversation that he had with Donald Trump just 2 months before the presidential election, and that the two men in this phone conversation discussed payments to a former Playboy model who said that she had an affair with Donald Trump.
So Trump has spent his entire presidency obsessed with being secretly recorded, and it turns out the only one who secretly recorded him was his own lawyer. Everyone from his past is coming back to haunt him. If he ever goes on trial, it's gonna look like the Seinfeld finale. But instead of the soup Nazi, there'll be actual Nazis. So now there's a secret recording that directly implicates Trump in a scheme to pay hush money to silence a Playboy model and possibly even implicates him in campaign finance violations and bank fraud. And it was made by his own lawyer. Now, you might feel bad for Donald Trump that his lawyer secretly taped him, but that's what you get when you hire a terrible lawyer. Remember, this is all hush-hush, Michael. Oh, I remember, because when you said it was hush-hush, I taped it, and then I played it back to make sure I heard you right. And then I put that tape in a box that said, hey, FBI, these tapes are none of your beeswax. But this explains why Trump is so scared of being secretly recorded. Whenever there is a transcript or recording of a secret meeting or phone call he or his team had, we find out they did something incriminating. It also explains why the people closest to Trump have repeatedly tried to set up secret back channels to Russia, or why he wanted to meet privately with Putin without aides, or why he wouldn't even tell his own intelligence heads about his plan to invite Putin to the White House, which resulted in this amazing clip last week of Dan Coats, the director of national intelligence, finding out about the invitation on stage from Andrea Mitchell.
We have some breaking news. The White House has announced on Twitter that Vladimir Putin is coming to the White House in the fall.
Say that again.
You, Vladimir Putin, coming.
Did I hear you?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's going to be special.
That's the director of national intelligence, which makes sense because under Trump, our national intelligence has basically devolved to
say what?
Trump has spent his entire presidency doing everything possible to evade both public oversight of his actions and his own intelligence agencies. And now it turns out it was his own lawyer who secretly recorded him. And I can't wait for that tape to be played in court because
that's going to be special.
This has been A Closer Look. Our guest is an MSNBC correspondent who's been reporting extensively from the U.S.-Mexico border. Please welcome to the show, Jacob Soboroff, everyone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, man.
So I want to start with this. You are obviously in a very reporting on a very difficult story right now. You're very composed, and yet I heard on your way out here you were at LAX and you lost your composure.
You heard about this?
Yes.
So I ran into Joe Biden.
Right.
So the backstory is, first of all, Joe Biden's like sitting by himself at LAX, by himself, 100% by himself, wearing the aviators in the corner. And I'm like, that's Joe Biden.
Yeah.
So I'm like, I got to go talk to Joe Biden. The backstory is my father-in-law in 1987, 88 worked on his presidential campaign. They were close. My wife told me we hung out with the Biden kids a lot, like great memories. So I'm like, I got to go tell him this. So I go up to Joe Biden. I say, hey, Mr. Vice President, I'm Jacob Soboroff from MSNBC. How are you? Hey, great to see you. So then I got nervous, and I said to him, my daughter, I don't have a daughter, is my father-in-law's wife. And I was like, and then I said it again. I was like, my daughter is my father-in-law's wife. And he, like, wasn't responding. And he kind of, like, takes the aviators, and he looks over, and I was like, oh, my wife is my wife, and my father-in-law is my father. I was like, he's like, oh, how are they? Tell them I said hello. So I'm sorry, Mr. Vice President, if you're watching tonight, and I'll never do that
so,
again.
That's so, yeah, that's like you were asking him a riddle.
It was bad. I was very uncomfortable.
My wife is my daughter-in-law is my father, so who's the doctor?
Exactly.
So you actually had been doing, even before the family separation policy went in place, you had been doing a wonderful piece about the border.
Yeah.
And you've been down there, and you actually spent time on every mile of the U.S.-Mexico border.
2,000 miles, yeah.
Which is incredible. And you, of course, I think we all have this image of the border based on the news reporting we see. You actually went down there and saw a different story than the sort of outrageous things we hear every day on the news.
It really is unbelievable to me to hear about how people, particularly the president, talk about what is going on down on the border as if it is just the most lawless, crazy area you've ever been to. It's some of the most wonderful people I've ever met in my entire life. Some of the safest cities in America are along the southern border. The idea that drugs are flowing in where there's no walls is factually incorrect. If the president took some time to read his own DEA reports, he would know that violence is not flowing across the border. He would know that drugs are coming in through legal ports of entry, and he would know that MS-13 is a tiny, 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 tiny percent of the people that come through. And the basically, they make policies that rip children away from their families and are truly ripping apart the fabric of society based on nonsense.
Now, you mentioned you met great people. This is a true thing that happened. Explain what happened, but this is a man who saw you.
Yeah, that's true.
He swam across to you to offer you...
Shrimp. So this is this is the Rio Grande, where the Rio Grande meets the Gulf of Mexico, and that's the very... southeasternmost point of the U.S. border. And this guy calls across to me, and he's like, "Hey, buddy." And I was like, "Hey." And he's like, "Do you want some shrimp?" And I said, "Yeah, come across. I'll take some shrimp." So the guy in that cooler also were limes, and that's the hot sauce right there. And so for $5, the whole thing with the militarized border and just all this divisiveness we've been seeing, the guy swam across and just blew my mind about everything that you think you know about what's going on. Yeah, yeah. So I thank this man very much. It was delicious.
Well, I've never once heard Trump say, "They're sending their shrimp."
No shrimp.
So you mentioned that the drugs are actually coming through the ports of entry that exist. Based on that, is what you're saying that a wall, while, you know, sort of as a symbol seems like a show of strength, would not actually fix any of the problems right now as far as the drug trade goes?
Yeah, no. And people, you know, shouldn't be surprised when the president knows this. It's in the DEA reports that he gets. And he continues to say over and over again, by the way, it also is not going to stop the vast majority of people that are coming to this country illegally. The majority of people that come into the country illegally fly here. From Asia, for the most part, and overstay their visas. And no wall is going to stop people flying in, obviously, from Asia.
Right. This is now, we're a few weeks after he signed the order to stop the family separations. They gave themselves a deadline of this Thursday to reunite all the families. Where are we at right now with that?
So let's talk about this. They're today, right now, as we sit here, 2,551 kids were ripped away from their parents by the Trump administration. And we should keep saying over and over again until every one of these kids is accounted for that this is not something that had ever happened before. It was a policy that was put into place to systematically take these kids away from their parents. It's a crisis on the scale of a natural disaster that was man-made by the Trump administration. This is a crisis of their own creation. Thursday is the deadline. They're now saying that something like 900 of the 2,551 have been reunited, but they're also saying over a third may never, ever be reunited, or at least it's going to be very complicated to put these people back together. And we just have to continue to demand answers from the administration because none of these kids should have been separated in the first place.
Now, that failure to reunite the children, is this a byproduct of how terribly planned this was to begin with?
Yeah, absolutely. There was never a plan. First of all, some of the shelters that I went to, and I went inside some of these places, it was the most harrowing experience as a father of a young kid like you that I've ever seen in my life. The shelters, for the most part, take good care of the kids, but they didn't know these kids were coming separated from their parents. The thing that disgusts me and I will never forget is that they took these kids away from their parents and put them in cages. And I was one of a small group of journalists that got to go inside the Border Patrol processing station in McAllen, Texas, and see these little kids sitting around under a watchtower playing by themselves because of the idea that Donald Trump thought it would scare other people from coming into this country. And now, because there was no plan to ever put it back together, you could have kids that their parents were already deported and they may never see them again.
There's this sense now that, you know, they're trying to fix it. Do you think they're trying to fix it because they realized how awful an act it was in the first place? Or do you think they're just trying to fix what has become a PR disaster?
No, and I'll tell you something. I saw Sean Spicer in this building.
Oh,
the former
press.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. I saw him in the building the other day, and I asked him, I said, "What'd you think about it?" And he said, "It was a mess." And he was saying it was a mess just like the Muslim ban was a mess. Because it wasn't well thought through. Not because this was inhumane to take kids away from their parents, not because, and that's the same thing with putting them back together, not because we feel bad about it, but because we just kind of messed up and it looked bad. And the president admitted that when we were down there from day one, when we were in the shelter in Brownsville, to day seven, I think it was, that he signed the executive order to put them back together. He basically said, I saw you guys on TV. I saw the writing. I saw the pictures. And that's sort of why we did this. It didn't look that good.
Yeah. You're doing incredible work. Thank you so much for continuing it. It's obviously very exciting for me to see you because I've been following the work you've been doing on TV. Other people are excited to see you because they think you're someone else.
Yeah, that's true. J.J. Abrams.
J.J. Abrams. Here, why don't you hold that up for us? Because I will think that, like, yeah, go right over there.
That's, I'm not nearly as rich. In fact, I'm not anywhere close to it. I would love to have the J.J. Abrams money, is what I say when people come up to me on the street. So, J.J., hit me up.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you very much for being here.
Can I have this?
Yeah, you can have that. That's the least we can do.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, thanks for being here, Jacob. Keep up the great work. I really appreciate it. Jacob Soboroff, everybody. He'll be reporting live from the Global Citizen Festival September 29th on MSNBC.
Hi, this is Henry from Late Night, here with Jacob Soboroff, MSNBC. You were talking to Seth about all the reporting you've done at the border. You covered every mile. What initially drew you to that story?
Well, I grew up in Southern California, and the life of a border town kind of extends further north into Los Angeles. Now, California is a majority-minority state, and so the idea of it being foreign and people from south of the southern border being foreign to me was kind of a foreign idea, you know.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I wanted to explore kind of the reality of what life is like, you know, not in Los Angeles but a little further south down by San Diego. And then we decided let's take it all the way across the southern border. What's life like? Not what they say in Washington, what it's like on the border, but what's life really like?
And are people on the border so frustrated with the national conversation about their lives?
Yeah, can you imagine if somebody was talking about your hometown every day and was saying that, like, oh, it's like bombs are going off in your hometown, and really, it's pretty chill down on the border. People are super nice. They love their way of life there. They love people on the other side of the border because in places like El Paso, I think 85% of the residents of El Paso are Latino, and many of them have relatives directly on the other side of the border.
And when you talk about El Paso, students literally travel back and forth to go to school. This is an amazing moment in your Dateline piece.
Yeah, thanks. So in El Paso, there are hundreds, if not thousands, I think, of kids that cross the border every single day. And they're American kids. Their parents are Mexican. So they are on the other side of the border basically at nighttime. And these kids come across the border. I mean, it was honestly one of the sweetest things I've ever seen. They go through the security line as if they're in line for the cafeteria at lunch.
That's what it looks like.
Yeah. And so there, it's like super normal to them. They get in this expedited line for students to go back and forth. They give their passport. Can you imagine every day having to give your passport in order to go to school? They put their bags through a metal detector and they kind of say what's up to the CBP agent, the Customs and Border Protection agent. And then they go on their way. And, they feel like what's happening now down along the border could basically rip their way of life apart and block them from being able to go back and forth. And it's a fundamental misunderstanding of what the border is really like.
Right.
You know, cherry picking statistics about groups like MS-13 or the idea of drugs coming across the border the least impactful case, and it's very impactful, put up a wall. The worst, rip children away from their parents and put them into cages.
Right. It's also interesting we talk about what the border looks like, what the border is. I think your piece so fundamentally showed that is a wrong way to think about the border.
Yeah.
There are many different conditions along the border. Can you talk about how things change with the topography and the different parts of the border?
It's a great point, and it's part of why, you know, the idea of deterrence doesn't work. This whole thing was about deterrence, separating kids from their families. Today, I'm sorry, back in 1993, when deterrence was first an official strategy of the Border Patrol.
Under Bill Clinton.
Yeah, under Bill Clinton. That's exactly right. The strategy was called prevention through deterrence. They put up the first wave of walls and wanted people to cross through deserts and harsh terrain, you know, so that they would think twice about coming across. And shocker, people didn't think twice. They decided to come ultimately through these more dangerous places. And the result of deterrence in that instance was more people died. Because people were crossing in the deadly, dangerous places like Ajo, Arizona, Aravaca, or South Texas brush. Mm-hmm. And so deterrence has consequences. When you're going to separate kids from their parents by sort of stopping the asylum process, people aren't going to declare asylum anymore, and they're going to make a run for it. And so what I thought was going to happen before the president signed the executive order is you're going to see little babies dying in the desert, just like we saw after 1993.
Right. Yeah, it's just brutal. There have been so many scandals with the Trump administration, so many things they've gotten public pushback on, but this seems different. And also, because of reporting like yours, the administration changed course. Can you talk about how you kind of experienced the power of journalism in this moment to actually affect change fairly quickly.
It is pretty shameful, the lack of transparency that this administration had around the locations where they were keeping these children. You know, number one was the shelters, and there are 100 of them throughout the country. Jeff Merkley, you know, there was that moment that kind of got us thinking about how do we get inside. Jeff Merkley, the senator from Oregon, went down there and got turned away from the facility Southwest Key Casa Padre in Brownsville. And we got invited by, because we'd been working on this special, by ORR and HHS to go inside. So once we got inside and actually saw the image, the place for ourselves, and then the following Sunday, which was Father's Day, got inside the facility in McAllen and saw the babies in the cages, it's when the conversation really started to amp up. And it wasn't just me. There were, you know, 9 other journalists both times in both of these places. Mm-hmm. But the press, I said it to Seth, it's like the president said it himself. He didn't like how it looked. He saw it and optics. He was seeing the pictures. And that's sort of what got him to change course. It doesn't mean that it's any less shameful, the lack of transparency, or that they're any more transparent, frankly. We haven't been inside one since.
Right.
Yeah. But up until this point, nobody had been inside. And I think just the simple fact of getting inside and being able to check the state-run images that they were releasing made a big difference.
Yeah. I also am just curious about your reporting career before you were reporting on this story. But you were at like AOL, you were at YouTube, you've reported on Instagram and Snapchat. How have those kind of like new media organizations kind of shaped you as a journalist?
Well, MSNBC in particular and NBC News are awesome about incorporating all of that stuff.
Yeah.
I never went to journalism school and I never did local news reporting. Mm-hmm. And at first I thought that was going to be just like my big fail and not get a job in this line of work. But now I realized that it's been kind of one of my big assets internally here. My bosses really value approaching stuff from kind of a different perspective.
Yeah.
So, and I have other colleagues that are excellent also in this same sort of vein, using social media in particular, better than me. And I feel like I'm the old guy now. You know, it's like there are much even younger correspondents. We have shows dedicated on Snapchat, but I try to just be on all platforms at all times when I'm out there because we want to reach everybody. And also, that's how you hear from people too. And for me, that's the best part of this job is that you hear from, it's like a feedback loop where you're hearing from people about the reporting and they help you further your own reporting and using that kind of technology.
Oh, is that true that you
all the
put
time
that stuff out? How does that happen exactly?
I get direct. I mean, I keep my DMs open. Uh-huh. So like on Twitter, I'll get private messages from people all the time being like, particularly on this border story, I heard this about this kid and this facility or you ought to go here. You ought to check into this. Here's some documents. And then we kind of go on a more of like an encrypted type software to communicate. But even on Snapchat and stuff, I'll hear from people and Instagram. At the end of the day, look, we work for a television network and that's where people are finding us. But the network is adapted. Both the network is adapting to the social media and the social media has really found a nice fit on the network.
Yeah, that's just interesting to hear that social media can influence then the TV reporting. Because I think people like dismiss reporting via social media as just a superfluous thing. That's,
I love hearing from people. I kind of learned to cool it on like arguing with people during the 2016 campaign because every time they would contact me, it was like, you're the big, you know.
How was covering the campaign? That's got to be
so fun.
Yeah.
So fun.
And
I know that I think we did a pretty good job because people hate me because they think I'm in the tank for Hillary and Donald Trump.
Okay.
You know?
It. Yeah.
That's when you know I think that you've done the solid reporting about it. And I had a cool job. I got to talk to the voters. You know, I didn't cover a candidate or a campaign. I got to talk to the voters. And again, that's like, that's the favorite part of my job, getting to hang out with real people on a regular basis because we can get stuck, you know, in this building here in 30 Rock just, you know, in all of our offices, but the news is made out there.
Yeah. Well, thank you for going out there and doing the work you're doing. This is such a pleasure to have you and congrats on reporting this story. I think it's really important, as you were saying out there, that the story is not done. The child separation story is not done. So I'm glad you're staying on it.
Thanks, Henry.
Appreciate
it, man.
Thanks so much.
Okay.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of plan investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.